Today's episode of Single Malt History with Gareth Russell will be broadcast in two parts. Welcome to Single Malt History with Gareth Russell, pouring out your serving of pure, distilled, intoxicating, and occasionally delicious history. Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to this, the fourth season of Single Malt History with me, Gareth Russell. My sincere thanks to everyone who sent such kind messages after the earlier than intended finale for season three. Today, in a leafy outpost of Northern Ireland's County Down, I'm taking us 11 miles up the road and two centuries into the past for this episode, Tales from Victorian Belfast. An eclectic buffet of nine stories from the north of Ireland's premier leading and or dominant town in the 1800s, from aristocrats on the outskirts, servants in the south, monks in the west, and murders in the east. I hope you'll enjoy, if that's the right word, these stories from 19th century Belfast, in which some of the original residents' words and songs in a single malt history first are going to be brought to life to us by some talented and very kind friends of mine. We're repeating what we did with the show's series on the Titanic's voyage in season one. So today I'm going to be joined by a troupe of some of Belfast's best upcoming and established actors. I cannot thank them enough for joining me to bring to life the words of the people who lived in and around Belfast at that time. And as I said, we will be having a first on the podcast with singer-songwriter Emily Rose joining us for the music while she sings an Irish refrain about the famine. We'll also be hearing versions of a Protestant hymn and the British national anthem too. To those who might be offended by one, two or three of those songs, there's not much I can do about that. The past happened, it matters, it's interesting, and I'm thrilled to share with you the music and the arrangements that mattered to the people at that time. A few quick housekeeping notes. The first is that there are four incidents briefly mentioned in this episode, which were so interesting that I think I'd like to do full episodes on them in the future. They are the downfall of the Bishop of Clocher in 1822, the cholera epidemic of 1834, the visit of Frederick Douglass in 1845, and Sir Otto Jaffa's emigration to Belfast in 1852. For the more pedantic amongst us, the two stories bookending this episode are not technically in the Victorian era, one in 1822, the other in 1903, Victoria, of course, being queen from 1837 until her death in 1901. However, those two respective stories seem to me to be a great starting and ending point for this set of tales, nine over nine decades, just about, of Belfast's history. More seriously and somberly, if I may, a content warning, which is that this episode contains in quotation use of contemporary historical racial language, as well as discussions of suicide, self-harm, domestic abuse and depression, which some listeners may find distressing. As I said, we'll be moving from 1822 through to 1903, and what a time period. Belfast began the 19th century as a town known for its radical politics. It ended it as a city famous for its conservatism. The town became a city, the radical yielded to the reactionary. In 1800, the town of Belfast in northeastern Ireland was still part of the estates owned by the Marquess of Donegal. Donegal being one of the nine counties of the northern province of Ulster in which Belfast is located. The county itself is usually spelled in English as Donegal, D-O-N-E-G-A-L, but the marquessate, with its antecedents dating from the reign of King Charles I, still uses the 17th century English spelling of Donegal, which is D-O-N-E-G-A-L-L. Which is why, if you go to Belfast today, you'll see streets and squares with the unusual spelling of Donegal with 2L, square, place, etc. The eldest son and heir of the Marquess goes by the courtesy title Earl of Belfast, and the family surname of Chichester is why Belfast has its Chichester streets and libraries. I'm aware we have visitors from all over the world, so I'm going to try and keep it generally accessible, obviously, for everyone, but also I'm going to include a few geographically specific details in case there are people listening from Belfast, or if you're traveling to Belfast and want to look up any of these sites yourself. The town of Belfast in 1800 had a predominantly Presbyterian population, many of whom had been active only 2 years earlier in the famous 1798 rebellion, the first rebellion that aimed to overthrow the monarchy in Ireland, establish an independent Irish Republic, and end the legal discriminations then in place against Irish Presbyterians and Catholics. A particular focus of their ire had been the Irish Parliament that met in Dublin, and which was dominated by the Ascendancy, the collective name given to the Irish aristocracy, nearly all of whom at this stage were members of the Church of Ireland, the regional branch of Anglican Episcopalianism. In response to the 98 uprising, the government in London decided to abolish the Dublin Parliament and unite the two parliaments, with Irish constituencies henceforth sending representatives to Parliament in London alongside English, Welsh, and Scottish MPs. This was achieved by a law called the Third Act of Union, passed in 1800 and coming into legal effect on New Year's Day 1801, which was also technically the birthday of the United Kingdom, as the Third Act of Union legally changed the country's name from Great Britain to the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, which lasted until 1921, but that's a story for another microphone. The Act of Union of 1800 ultimately helped take the vim and vigour out of Presbyterian radicalism in the north of Ireland. Many of them were so delighted to see the end of the Ascendancy Parliament in Dublin that they became enthusiastic supporters of the new political system established by the Union, calling themselves Unionists. The Ascendancy continued to be called the Ascendancy even after they were no longer in the Ascendant. They were not quite out for the count, however, and the Ascendancy continued to exert a great deal of influence in Irish politics, especially in the north, with the generation born in and around the Union, as they ditched the nostalgia of their parents' generation to embrace the Unionist cause as their own. Perhaps the most famous or notorious of that generation in and around the Act of Union was the second Marquess of Londonderry, which brings us to the first of our nine tales. Chapter 1. Lord Londonderry's Suicide. On the 13th day of August 1822, the town of Belfast woke to the news that the Marquess of Londonderry had slit his throat. The 53-year-old Robert Stuart, 2nd Marquess of Londonderry, had been staying at his country estate in southeastern England, Woollett Hall, when he walked into his dressing room, picked up a knife, and killed himself. His English wife, the famous Georgian socialite born Lady Amelia Hubert, had been so concerned about her husband's mental well-being in the days preceding his suicide that she and their servants had tried to hide every possible sharp object, fatally and fatefully missing the small knife hidden by the Marquess. Britain's new King, George IV, having seen the Marquess's distress firsthand at their most recent meeting, had dispatched a personal note to the Marquess that read, "Remember how dear your health is to the country, and above all to me." Coming from Scotland, the King's letter reached Woollett after Londonderry's death, which was discovered by the Marquess's personal physician, Charles Bankhead. Dr. Bankhead had slept in the room next to his patients. That's how worried he was about him. On the morning that the Marquess died, Lady Londonderry had just gotten out of bed. She was chatting with her maid, Miss Robinson, who had passed her a dressing gown, when they heard the doctor's cries. Dr. Bankhead had gone into the Marquess's dressing room, where he saw Lord Londonderry standing, facing out the window over the estate, but with his head tilted up, staring at the ceiling. Without turning round, the Marquess said,
"'Tis all over."
The Marquess is played throughout today's episode by actor Jake Douglas. The following, with Danny Cunningham as Dr. Charles Bankhead and Paul Storrs as the coroner is taken from the exact transcript from the inquiry into Lord Londonderry's death.
Did he see you?
No. I was running into the room. As he fell on me, I saw that he had a knife in his right hand, very firmly clenched.
Did you see him use it?
No.
Are the jury to understand that he used it before you saw him?
I think it was done the instant I put my foot on the threshold of the door. From the nature of the wound, death must have followed in the twinkling of an eye. There could not have been less than 3 quarts of blood which flowed from him in 1 minute. I am quite satisfied that it was not a minute from my entering the room till he was dead. His death was almost instantaneous. He never uttered another word.
Could the wound have been inflicted while you were coming from the door?
Certainly, for as I caught him I saw the knife bloody, and in falling, a burst of blood took place like a torrent from a watering pot. I was unable to support him, and he fell on the floor.
You are quite sure, from all you saw and heard, and from your own good sense, that he used the knife himself?
It is impossible that it could have been done by any other human being. There was no one in the room with him but myself, and death must necessarily follow in half a minute from the infliction of such a wound.
When pressed about the Marquess's mental well-being at the time of his death, Dr. Bankhead replied,
I have not the least hesitation in saying, from knowing the deceased intimately for the past 30 years, that he was perfectly insane.
From what period?
I had noticed a great decline in him for some weeks, in his general habit and in his health. But I was not aware of the mental delusion under which he was labouring till within 3 or 4 days of his decease.
The reaction in Belfast to the Marquess of Londonderry's death was mixed. His family were impossible to ignore, for although the Donegal Chichesters were technically the aristocrats most relevant to Belfast, in reality it was the Marquess of Londonderry's family, the Stuarts, who were the most obvious great family in the region by the 1820s. They were building their new home, Mount Stuart, like a summer palace on the banks of the Ards Peninsula, 14 miles to the east of the city. In Belfast, the Marquess's suicide was therefore big news, but in Belfast, as elsewhere, Lord Londonderry had a varying reputation. To some, the Marquess was a hero who had helped restore stability to Europe and, in particular, ensured through his actions that the French Revolution had not spread into Ireland. But to others, the slim, elegant and emotionally controlled Marquess was a lying conservative hack who had betrayed Ireland and in particular her Catholic citizens, and who had then facilitated the establishment of a conservative order throughout Europe that had stifled the hopes and dreams of every liberal on the continent. The Marquess's enduring unpopularity with some had been vividly demonstrated in the months before his suicide, when the windows of his house in London were smashed in with rocks thrown by protesters who resented him for his friendship with King George. At the time, the marriage between George IV and his estranged German wife, Caroline of Brunswick, was falling apart, and the people of London had overwhelmingly sided with Queen Caroline. Prominent friends of the King's were targeted by the Queen's squad of sympathisers, whose targets included Lord Londonderry. Matters were not helped by Queen Caroline's sudden death, quite possibly in combined consequence of her alcoholism, her dependence on sleeping aids and laxatives, and long-standing problems with her diet. Even at Lord Londonderry's own funeral a year later, some of the dead Queen's most impassioned loyalists proved that they could hold a grudge by laughing and hissing as the Marquess's coffin passed them by. Others, as mentioned, disliked the Marquess for his politics. At the time of his death, Lord Londonderry had been the British Foreign Secretary, serving in that demanding government post for the past decade. Before that, coming from one of the most prominent families in the ascendancy, he had been Chief Secretary of Ireland in the years immediately after the 1798 rebellion. in which capacity he had been a prominent architect in the drafting and passing of the Act of Union. Unionists thus celebrated Lord Londonderry for the prominent role he had played in creating the Union in the first place. But others, especially some who had fought for the rebels in 1798, remembered that Lord Londonderry, who had held the junior title of Lord Castlereagh while his father, the old Marquess, lived, had also been one of the chief architects of the rebellion's suppression. So despite their shared views on the benefits of the Union, many in Belfast disliked him. Lord Castlereagh had never really warmed to Presbyterians either, despite the fact that he descended from Ulster Scots Presbyterians on his father's side. He distrusted them, feeling that their radicalism and their ability to rebel when things didn't go their way were never too far beneath the surface. As a note, although he was properly the Marquess of Londonderry by the time of his death in 1822, his late father's longevity meant the second Marquess spent most of his life as Lord Castlereagh, and it's that title that continued to be used by many, including friends and foes up to and after his death. As it's the most frequently used in the quotations that are about to follow, I'll be referring to Londonderry as Castlereagh going forward. After Castlereagh's death, a famous poem mocking him was quoted by many of his opponents in both Ireland and England. Written by one of Castlereagh's liberal English critics, it memorably allegorised him as the living embodiment of conservative repression.
"I met murder on my way. He had a face like Castlereagh. Very smooth he looked, yet grim. Seven bloodhounds followed him. All were fat, and well they might be in admirable plight. For one by one and two by two, he tossed them human hearts to chew."
But what had happened to bring death to Castlereagh himself? As Shelley's poem makes clear, Castlereagh was seen by his enemies as a cold, aloof, almost emotionless automaton of autocracy. Beneath the cool exterior, however, there had always been an undercurrent of mental disquiet, hidden away by Castlereagh's preternatural self-control until he could hide it no longer. He was neurotic about his weight for most of his adult life, but the first specific incident that we know of that really raised alarm bells came when he was about 23 years old and temporarily living in Ballyshannon in County Donegal. It was early in his political career, and Castlereagh had been sent to the coast of northwestern Ireland to help with the government's attempts to uncover a conspiracy in the region. He believed, correctly as it turned out, that the emerging Irish Republican movement, who would later lead the 98 Rebellion, were secretly liaising with the new government of Revolutionary France. Castlereagh would later refer to this as the conspiracy, and his belief in the links between Irish republicanism and the French Revolution goes a very long way in explaining the ferocity of his hatred towards the rebels of 1798. One night in Ballyshannon, Castlereagh woke up from a deep sleep to be confronted by what he believed was a warning spirit, an innocent, spectral child who transformed in front of his horrified eyes into a blood-soaked, screaming victim with lines of woe, despair and blood over its face. This spectre, Castlereagh firmly believed, had been sent to show him what would happen to Ireland if the values of the French Revolution were allowed to spread to her shores. His first major nervous breakdown happened 8 years after that, in his early 30s, just after the Act of Union was passed. One of the many reasons why Castlereagh had championed the passing of the Act of Union was because he was convinced that its passage would prompt the simultaneous enacting of Catholic emancipation throughout the United Kingdom. Since the downfall of King James II 120 years earlier, Irish and British Catholics had been subject to various discriminations, including being denied the right to vote or sit in Parliament. Castlereagh was certain that with the Act of Union between the parliaments of Great Britain and the people of a predominantly Catholic kingdom like Ireland, Catholic emancipation would be passed, thereby rewarding and justifying early Irish Catholic support for the Union. But when the Union was passed without Catholic emancipation, Castlereagh sank into a deep depression. Spotting him one day at court, King George III singled Lord Castlereagh out to upbraid him in front of a large crowd for supporting Catholic emancipation, publicly accusing him of being little better than a revolutionary. Mocked by his conservative allies for pushing Catholic emancipation and reviled by his former Catholic allies in Ireland for failing to secure it, Castlereagh seems to have suffered a breakdown. There was another breakdown 7 years later in 1808, although it's not quite so clear what initially prompted this particular phase in his struggle with depression. 7 years later, in 1815, Castlereagh achieved what he regarded as the glory of his career when he represented Britain at the Congress of Vienna, the International Diplomatic Summit, to decide on the peace settlement that would follow the collapse of the French Revolutionary Wars and the Bonapartist Empire they had unwittingly birthed. The Congress of Vienna was to inaugurate nearly three unbroken decades of conservative political triumph in Europe, for which Castlereagh was toasted by some and damned by others. The Chancellor of the Austrian Empire, Prince Clemens von Metternich, considered Castlereagh to be one of the great men of their generation. Von Metternich, too, is controversial, seen by many as one of the practical founding fathers of modern European conservatism. Lord Castlereagh knew he was despised by many, and as he grew older, he found that harder and harder to deal with it. He believed, too, that as the years passed, people in Ireland must have forgotten that the rebels of 1798 had been in league with the revolution in France. Truth be told, Castlereagh was being hopelessly naive or self-deluding if he thought that the memory of that fact would have made him popular with many people in Ireland. But as Castlereagh himself put it,
"With respect to Ireland, I know I shall never be forgiven. For what reason? Because I exerted myself to defend the people of Ireland from the conspiracy which surrounds them? My conduct has been the constant target of invective. But I think those who are acquainted with me will do me the justice of believing that I never had a cruel or unkind heart."
On what turned out to be his last visit home to Ireland, however, Castlereagh was cheered in its streets. George III, king from 1760 until his death in 1820, had been, as we have seen, a zealous opponent of Catholic emancipation. But his son, successor, and Castlereagh's friend, King George IV, was expected to support it, and he did. It was passed into law with the Catholic Relief Act of 1829. Knowing of the new king's sympathy for Catholic civil rights and Lord Castlereagh's friendship with that king, the two men were celebrated by large crowds when they visited Dublin in 1821. Clearly touched and surprised by this reception, Castlereagh wrote of his Dublin trip,
"I have not heard an unkind word from a single individual, and I have mixed with the people as much as I can. I am proud of my country."
But this happier mood, this revived spirits, didn't last. Once he was back in London, Lord Castlereagh's behaviour began to give more and more cause for concern. He was frustrated by what he saw as his failures. Catholic emancipation was coming, but it was coming a generation later than it had been promised. He had other large failures too, weighing on mind and conscience. Although he had used his position to help support the abolitionist cause in the British Empire and to help capture slave ships and liberate their victims before they could be trafficked further, Castlereagh had nonetheless failed to seriously advance any legislation that meaningfully undercut the institution of slavery in the empire. As Foreign Secretary, Castlereagh had, however, been looking forward to a diplomatic or official trip back to Vienna, scene of his greatest, as he saw it, triumph 7 years earlier, and of course home to his friend and ally Chancellor von Metternich, as well as being the city where Castlereagh's younger brother then lived. But then suddenly depression took that from him too, and the thought of this trip to which he had been so looking forward seemed suddenly to overwhelm him. Trying to cheer him up, a friend said, "Why not focus on this trip to Vienna? To which Lord Castlereagh replied,
"At any other time I should have liked it very much, but I am quite worn out. Quite worn out. Quite worn out. And this fresh load of responsibility is more than I can bear."
During a conversation with a medical doctor, Castlereagh seemed to ask an inordinate number of questions about the best way to end one's life. He ended that conversation by saying politely to the doctor,
"You must think me very ignorant, but I am rather curious about such matters."
The king's latest mistress disliked Lord Castlereagh, and he convinced himself that she was trying to turn King George against him. Then, at a state dinner in London, held in honour of the visiting Crown Princess of Denmark, Lord Castlereagh seemed erratic, paranoid, and angry. His friend and fellow guest at that dinner, Princess Dorothea von Leven, wife of the Russian ambassador, was startled by how aggressively he spoke at her as they were going through to dinner. When the Duke of Wellington, the famous British military commander and politician, who was also a fellow member of the Irish Ascendancy, appeared a little bit distant in conversation with Castlereagh, the latter became extremely distressed and told people that his friend Wellington must have found out a shameful secret about him. That was why he was being so cold. The Duke had to call to see Castlereagh personally to assure him that he'd simply been a bit off because he was distracted with a political matter. It had nothing to do with his friendship with Lord Castlereagh. Then a scandal broke about Ireland, and Lord Castlereagh went over the edge completely. On a summer's evening, the Right Reverend and the Honourable Percy Jocelyn, His Grace the Bishop of Clocher, was caught in the back room of a pub in a compromising position with a handsome soldier. Homosexuality had been a death penalty offence since a law passed by Henry VIII in 1533, but that law was very seldom enforced. Still, it was enough to destroy lives and eviscerate careers. Bishop Jocelyn, like Lord Castlereagh, was a member of the Ascendancy in the North. His father was the Earl of Roden. One of their family estates was in Castlewellan, 30 miles from Belfast. The scandal of the Bishop of Clocher's homosexuality was so great that every Protestant bishop in the country was apparently being laughed at in the streets. Clocher had to resign, change his name, and go into hiding. Poems were made mocking him and the church. Some laughed, many more shuddered in disgust. Public revulsion at the Bishop of Clocher's behaviour was intense. It was all anybody could talk about by the time Lord Castlereagh turned up for an audience with the King at Windsor Castle on the 8th of August, 5 days before he took his own life. From the moment Castlereagh walked in to see him, George IV could see something was very wrong. The Foreign Secretary, normally a model of dignity, could neither sit nor stand still, his speech equally frantic. Out of nowhere, Castlereagh burst into tears and confessed to the startled king that he had committed the same crime as the Bishop of Clocher. "Somebody knew," Castlereagh rambled. "People knew." He suspected that was what the Duke of Wellington must have found out. His reassurances notwithstanding didn't make sense. That's what he had to know. He had to have found that out. The king, due to depart the next day for a very important royal visit to Scotland, through which he hoped to build bridges with the remnants of the Jacobite cause, was shocked and tried to calm Castlereagh down. I'm not usually one who finds much to say by way of praise for George IV, but I have to say in this particular audience, he does emerge with quite good intentions. He politely, tactfully pretended not to believe Castlereagh's confession and urged the Marquess to take a leave of absence. And above all else, would he please see a doctor for his nerves? But Castlereagh kept repeating he was ruined and that he must flee, as the disgraced bishop had. He should go abroad into hiding. The king repeated that all he needed to do was take a few weeks off, a few months off, see a doctor, and go and rest in the countryside. One detail that we don't know for certain is whether or not Castlereagh was being blackmailed with exposure of his homosexuality. Princess Dorothea von Lieven heard later that at that final audience with the king, Castlereagh actually showed George IV letters from his blackmailers, but Princess von Lieven was never able to confirm whether or not that was true. Before leaving London for his country estate in Kent, as the king had suggested, Castlereagh told another friend, Mrs. Arbuthnot, that he had gone to a male brothel 3 years earlier and that he had been blackmailed about that ever since. Given Castlereagh's agitation, Mrs. Arbuthnot didn't know how much of that was true either. Crucially, however, Castlereagh's wife Amelia knew and later admitted in a letter to a friend that she believed that fear over being exposed by his blackmailers was what had prompted her husband's suicide. It seems perhaps it could have been a combination of short-term stresses, such as being targeted by Queen Caroline's more zealous supporters, then his feud with the king's mistress, and then, of course, the general inescapable stress of having a government post as high-ranking and important as Foreign Secretary, had all then perhaps fatally mixed with Castlereagh's long-term insecurities, mental ill health, possible guilt over the failure to pass Catholic emancipation in the wake of the Act of Union, failure too to substantially legislatively advance the anti-slavery cause, and hiding his sexuality for the entirety of his adult life while trying to fend off blackmailers. Only 2 days, and I say for all of his life because it is possible that that detail that he told Mrs. Arbuthnot that he'd been blackmailed for the last 3 years since the visit to the brothel, her doubts about that may be justified. Because only 2 days after his suicide, one of Castlereagh's friends admitted to another that Lord Castlereagh had in fact been blackmailed throughout his entire political career about his homosexuality, and that finally, at the very end, he shattered under the pressure of it. Others, who knew the late Marquess very well, including, I think tellingly, letters from and to his brother, who was then the British ambassador to Austria, were very careful as to what they put on paper solely about that. They're quite specific about what they call his delirium, about the nature of his wounds, but after being frank about that, one of the ambassador's correspondents then writes, "There is but one subject on which there remains anything to say, and that is the matter on which turned the different moments of his delirium. This I will reserve for future conversations when we meet." Lord Castlereagh, by then Lord Londonderry, major architect of the Act of Union and of the Congress of Vienna, was buried at Westminster Abbey. His title as Marquess of Londonderry passed to his younger brother Charles. The Irish politician Henry Grattan, a prominent anti-unionist and a general critic of Lord Castlereagh's politics, had once magnanimously said to his son, "Don't be hard on Castlereagh, for he too loves Ireland." Another liberal opponent, the Member of Parliament Henry Brougham, who had debated many times with Castlereagh, said, "One can't help feeling a little for him. After being pitted against him for several years pretty regularly, it's like losing a connection suddenly. Also, he was a gentleman, and the only one amongst them," by which Brougham meant the Tories. A particularly kind, if unintended, tribute came from one of Lord Castlereagh's servants, who told the Inquiry that they knew his employer was in some kind of distress because one day he spoke sharply to me. When pressed, the servant replied that it was so unlike the Marquess to speak rudely or dismissively to anybody, especially servants, that it meant something must have been very wrong with him that day. But politics does not always stop with death, and hearing that Castlereagh, who was played brilliantly in this episode by actor Jake Douglas, was buried at Westminster, his opponent Lord Byron suggested that the epitaph should read,
"Posterity will never survey a nobler grave than this, for here lies the bones of Castlereagh. Stop, traveller, and piss."
Chapter 2, A letter from Carnlough. In late 1845, a letter arrived for the Marchioness of Londonderry from one of her agents, telling her that it looked like something was wrong with the potato harvest in Carnlough, or as he put it, something that looked like cholera for potatoes had arrived at Lady Londonderry's estates about 30 miles north of Belfast. At exactly the same time as Lady Londonderry was getting this letter, farms all over Ireland, large and small, were noticing the same thing. A journalist for the Belfast-based newspaper, The Northern Whig, went to see what was happening. He reported back to his readers.
Mostly every potato field that the eye could light on has the appearance of having been blighted by frost, and in most instances the petals of the blossoms are observed to wither and shed in the course of a few hours.
2 years later, Lady Londonderry had stopped collecting rent from their tenants in Carnlough and on her estate at neighbouring Ballymacaldrick because nobody could pay it. A soup kitchen established in Newtownards, the once prosperous town in the shadow of the Londonderry's Mount Stuart estate, was doling out 100 gallons of soup every day to the hungry. Whatever was wrong with the potatoes, the blight spread through Ireland, decimating the food supply, plunging the poorest families into starvation, then working its insidious way through the country, communities, placing intolerable strain on the entire supply chain. In Belfast, another local newspaper, the Belfast Vindicator, ran the editorial.
It is, unhappily, too evident that Ireland is now suffering under an awful calamity. Famine, disease, and premature death prevailing to some degree everywhere in this island. Accounts multiply of destitution and suffering and death in their most appalling forms. The cry of distress is becoming louder every day. The prospects for the future are very dark.
The famine, for that was what it was at its most perniciously deadly in the south and west of Ireland, particularly in the provinces of Connaught and Munster, where its impact approached the apocalyptic. 1 million Irish people died of hunger. That's 1 out of every 8 in the population died of hunger. 2 million emigrated. On the day that those letters had started arriving from Carnlough to Lady Londonderry and to farmers all over the country in 1845, the Irish population stood at about 8.5 million. On the day I'm recording this for you in 2023, it's still not back up to 8.5 million, it's 6.8. And that's combining Northern Ireland with the population of the Republic of Ireland, meaning that the entire island of Ireland still has not demographically recovered from the impact of what happened in the 1840s. And the lore of the famine, the cultural shared memory of its horrors, settled. 2 generations later, Maggie McKinley was one of many ordinary people interviewed by historians about the famine. Her words are read here by actress Ashley Montgomery, who uses, Maggie uses, the word minded. It's a Ulster and also a Scottish colloquialism. Minded meant remembered, kept in their memory.
My grandmother minded the famine. She said there was a boat come into the bay here that took over 100 people, whole families. She had 5 or 6 sisters and 2 brothers, and they all went away. A whole lot died on the boat going over, though. From here, I think they mostly went to Eastport and Maine. A lot went to Boston.
But in some senses, particularly compared to other parts of Ireland, the North and Belfast in particular are anomalies in this collective commemoration of the famine in Ireland's cultural memory. In a very large part, this was because with its different topography, neither Belfast nor Ulster were as badly impacted by the famine of the 1840s as other parts of Ireland. Belfast was an affluent coastal town with an economy increasingly developing towards trade and industry rather than agriculture. And yet, suffering is almost never stationary. The scale of horror in the 1840s was so enormous that even areas not directly initially affected by the failure of the crop, the potato crop that by the 1840s formed a huge part of people's diets, particularly in the West and South, were nonetheless changed by it. And Belfast was no exception. The failure of the potato, the blight, was the first in a series of agricultural disasters that multiplied thanks initially to terrible weather. The famine, it's true, as I've said, hit the north less than it hit the south and west, but the areas of the north that it did touch were also the areas of the north least socially and agriculturally equipped to cope with it. The northern counties, for instance, of Cavan and Monaghan, saw their populations fall by a third due to death and migration. The north's western county of Tyrone fared almost as badly. The soup kitchen previously mentioned in the town of Newtownards was in County Down, traditionally one of the wealthiest parts of Ireland. And there were horrible stories from other counties in the north, such as the privately run soup kitchen in Donegal that would only give porridge to the hungry if they converted to Protestantism. Other private soup kitchens where the rare treat of meat to the free food was added to the food on Friday, in the knowledge that the Catholic Church prohibited its members from eating meat on Fridays in commemoration of the crucifixion of Christ. While some landlords, like Lady Londonderry as mentioned, stopped collecting rent, others refused to do so and allowed their agents to evict families who didn't have enough to feed themselves, let alone make rent. Protestant-run newspapers in Belfast criticised these hideous attempts to persecute the poor further, or anyone who tried to find a way to only give charitable food to hungry Protestants rather than anybody who needed it. And the people of Belfast established the Belfast Relief Fund to raise money to help not just hungry communities in the north, but also those in the western county of Mayo and the southern city of Cork, both of which were particularly badly impacted. Before the famine of the 1840s, Belfast had been an overwhelmingly Protestant town, specifically, as mentioned, Presbyterian. But the complete collapse of the rural infrastructure, coupled with the evictions from estates by those who couldn't pay their rent, led to an influx of immigrants to Belfast seeking food and work. This migration from the impacted county saw the first numerically substantial Catholic community settled in Belfast. And they settled mostly in and around the town markets and later in the western section of Belfast. Now, there had been a large enough Catholic community there before the famine to require the building of a suitable church in the town centre near the markets, the absolutely extraordinary St. Malachy's Church on Alfred Street. If you're visiting Belfast, go and see St. Malachy's. It's so underrated even by people who live here. Its Tudor-era inspired architecture with those Baroque flourishes is really something. But back to the topic at hand. In the wake of the famine and its aftermath, the number of Catholics living in Belfast increased substantially, altering both the religious and, in the future, political demographics of the town. Why do I say political as well as religious? Well, it really is to do with what we appreciate as the impact of the famine, and any medievalist or early modernist will tell you that famines were a recurring horror in Europe before the 19th century, until industrialization and capitalism made mass food production possible, after which the famines seem to have receded into history. Because of that, some revisionist historians have attempted to argue that the Irish famine of the 1840s remains as notorious as it does because it was the last mass-scale famine in Western Europe. There might be something to that argument, but in my opinion, not much. There are two other more important features that set apart the famine of the 1840s. The first we can tell from its sobriquets, the Great Famine, the Great Hunger and Gortamór, and Rochill, the Hard Times, the Bad Times. The hunger of the 1840s was greater in scale and thus deeper in suffering than many of the other famines in Western European history. There is no question that what happened in the famine years was horrific, especially in the West and South. But to go back to that comparison, The comparatively unaffected north and certain parts of the east were only comparatively unaffected if compared to the rest of Ireland. Compared to the rest of the United Kingdom, even Belfast was staring down the barrel of a gun loaded with absolute horror for most of the 1840s. And it's that comparison that matters to what happened next. Not compared to the rest of Ireland, but to the rest of the United Kingdom. A key tenet of the Act of Union of 1800 had been that Ireland was as much a part of the United Kingdom as the leafiest suburb in southern England, as Margaret Thatcher would famously put it a century later, Northern Ireland is as British as Finchley High Street. And yet, a mere 40 years into the Union, 1 million Irish people had died of hunger. According to the Union, they were 1 million British citizens at a time in Britain's history where it was the wealthiest country on earth, and not by a close margin. How had that happened? How do a million people in the United Kingdom starve to death in the 1840s? Would the government have reacted so appallingly if the famine had swept through Berkshire, their critics asked, or Kent, or Essex, or Hampshire? Would the government have sat in London and piously proclaimed their free trade platitudes while a million died in Sussex, and the hunger-drawn survivors evicted from their homes flooded into Knightsbridge? For critics, the famine shone a devastating, damning, unforgiving light on the Union. To its critics, it proved that the Union was a charade, a farce that had ceased to be funny when a million lives were snuffed out on its watch, and then asked why the people of Ireland were so angry. Now, it should be pointed out that in the years that lay ahead, the mythology about the government's response was to fudge some of the details and outright misrepresent others. It's not true, for instance, that the government went through Ireland deliberately harvesting up the corn and exporting it themselves to ensure that as many died as possible. The government devoted after 1847 on an almost religious level to the doctrine of free trade, instead refused to interfere, that's how they put it, not intervene, interfere in the free market. So they stood back, allowed, facilitated, failed to disincentivize the exportation of food out of Ireland by private companies and traders. As the country buckled with collapsing food supplies, the government point blank refused to introduce tariffs or duties that would at least encourage the companies to keep the food in Ireland and sell it there. So while they didn't skip through the countryside stealing food, they nonetheless completely and reprehensibly failed in their duty to provide for their most vulnerable citizens on a scale that boggles the imagination. The government's policies allowed Irish food to leave Ireland during a famine. They knew that's what their fair trade policies were doing. Free trade policies, sorry, not fair trade. Fair trade. They knew that's what their free trade policies were doing. But even then, they wouldn't change them. Any relief the government sent to Ireland was too little, too late, too ineffective. It was like using a cork to try to dam the hole in the side of the Titanic. Members of the government apparently even got annoyed when the young Queen Victoria sent £4,000 of her own money to a famine relief charity. The government griped that the Queen's actions had shown them up, and that thus they were perhaps unconstitutional. That, by the way, is what British cabinets say when the royals say or do anything that vaguely shines a light on immorality in the government's policies. Unconstitutional. So not only were the government in the 1840s not doing enough to help, they were angry with anybody else trying to do something. Particular loathing was reserved in Ireland for a civil servant called Sir Charles Trevelyan, who dispersed famine relief money and emergency food supplies far more efficiently during a food shortage in Scotland than he did with Ireland. When the government doubled down and claimed harvest failure was a natural act, an act of God, as Trevelyan notoriously put it, the Irish journalist and lawyer John Mitchell played by Danny Cunningham, put pen to paper with absolute fury. Mitchell argued that through their actions, the government may as well have killed the famine's victims themselves, and that it had been the government's callously inept response to the problem that turned the blight into a famine.
1.5 million men, women, and children were carefully, prudently, and peacefully slain by the English government. They died of hunger in the midst of abundance, an abundance that their own hands had created. It is quite immaterial to distinguish those who perish in the agonies of famine itself from those who died of typhus fever, which in Ireland is always caused by famine. Further, I have called it an artificial famine. That is to say, it was a famine which desolated a rich and fertile island that produced every year abundance and superabundance to sustain all her people and many more. The English, indeed, called that famine a dispensation of providence, and they ascribe it entirely to the blight of the potatoes. But potatoes failed in like manner all over Europe. Yet there was no famine, except in Ireland. The British account of the matter then is first, fraud. Second, it is a blasphemy. The Almighty, indeed, sent the potato blight, but the English created the famine.
For some, Mitchell's commentary was flamboyant and misleading. Despite what he said, there had been other shortages of food in Scotland, Scandinavia, and Eastern Europe. It also was not true that there hadn't been famines in Ireland before. There had been a particularly terrible one in different circumstances, but a terrible one that happened in the 1720s. So there were details in what Mitchell said that weren't historically accurate, but for many others reading what Mitchell wrote, he nonetheless had hit the mark. The government then added to its skyrocketing unpopularity by notoriously refusing to relax the penalties for those desperately caught stealing food to feed their families. Once again, siding with those exporting it and failing to distribute corn, government corn, quickly enough themselves. The desperate men were caught and deported to Australia. And it appeared to the government's mushrooming number of critics as if, confronted by one of the most appalling humanitarian catastrophes of the century, their government was doing everything it could to frustrate any attempt to soften the famine's impact. And this was immortalised in perhaps one of the most famous Irish songs, The Fields of Athenry, which imagines a conversation between a heartbroken wife whose husband, Michael, is due to be deported on an Australia-bound prison ship the next morning after he was caught stealing corn for their children. To sing this, I am so excited to welcome to Single Malt History for the first time Emily Rose, a friend of mine and a singer-songwriter from Belfast. You can find out more about Emily Rose at her website, www.emily-roseweddings.com, and also on her Instagram, emily_rose_weddings. And also, of course, on the ubiquitous Facebook. I am delighted she's here, and I'm sure you'll agree this is a special and beautiful recording of the first two verses of The Fields of Athenry.
By a lonely prison wall, I heard a young girl calling, "Michael, they are taking you away, for you stole Trevelyan's corn. So the young men see the morn. Now a prison ship lies waiting in the bay. No lie, the fields of Athenry, where once we watched the small free birds fly. Our love was on the wings had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Athenry, by a lonely prison wall. I heard a young man calling. Nothing matters, Mary, when you're free. Against the famine and the crown, I rebel, they cut me down. Now you must raise a child with dignity. No, Athenry, where once we watched the small free birds fly. Our love was on the wing. We had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely round the fields of Athenry.
Tellingly, the Fields of Athenry is now generally regarded by many unionists as a nationalist song. Now, in part, that is because later versions of the song do incorporate modern republican terminology. Culturally, however, the Fields of Athenry helps pinpoint a painful moment in which the unionist cause was, for many Irish people, finished. The 29-year delay in Catholic emancipation had already counted against the Union. The 1840s killed it. Who, Irish nationalists argued, could possibly still believe the Union's claim that all four countries in the United Kingdom were equal to one another when they looked at how the government had responded to Ireland in the 1840s? The Union was a pious lie that failed to offer any help when it was most needed. One man who held such a view was John Martin, a politician from Newry in County Down, who joined the pro-independence Young Irelander movement in the 1840s. Arrested but acquitted, Martin, played here by Caelum Carraher, defended himself by telling his accusers that he and many like him now believed Irish independence was essential and in the best interests of every Irish citizen, regardless of class or religion.
My object in everything that I have done has been simply to establish the independence of Ireland for the benefit of all the people of Ireland. Aristocrats, clergymen, judges, professional men, in fact, all Irishmen. I sought that objective first because I thought it was our right. Because I thought and think still that national independence was the right of the people of this country. And secondly, I admit that being a man who prefer a quiet life, I never would have engaged in politics if I had not thought it necessary to do all in my power to make an end of the horrible scenes the country presents. The pauperism and starvation and crime and vice and hatred of all the classes against each other. I thought that there should be an end to that horrible system, which, while it lasted, gave me no peace of mind, for I could not enjoy anything in my country so long as I saw my countrymen forced to be vicious, forced to hate each other, and be degraded to the level of pauper and brute. This is the reason I engaged in politics.
Unionism did not die. However, it is perhaps revealing that it grew stronger in the areas of Ireland least impacted by the famine. And there were nuances too, lost in the retelling. There always are when history becomes part of a memory. Some critics felt that with its vast wealth, the Catholic Church could and should have done a lot more than it did to help ease the suffering during the Great Hunger. Others argued that the British government had started with better responses until the general election of 1847 kicked the Tories out and brought into power the more free trade obsessed Whigs, with Lord Russell as Prime Minister from 1847 to 1852. No relation. The ideology of the respective parties, I should note, was quite different from what they are in the 2020s. It's also been pointed out that the government's attitude to the workhouse and or unemployed poor of England was appalling at the time, and that there's no guarantee that they wouldn't have been as bone-chillingly indifferent to the suffering of the poor wherever it was in the United Kingdom. Some socialist historians have also pointed out that by seeing this response in national or nationalist terms, Britain or England and Ireland, that we're missing the point of the real lesson taught with the catastrophe of the famine, which is that a hardline devotion to libertarian or free market capitalism is insufficient in times of crisis and potentially lethally destructive. That has been the argument put forward by some socialist historians, along with the other previous discussions of the role of the church and what happened with that election of 1847. Historians usually grapple with the very best intentions with these issues on subjects as protean as the famine of the 1840s, and it's right that they do so. They're not usually trying to minimalise suffering so much as understand it better, how it was possible, how it was endured, how it was ended. History, like humans, is often complex, that's true. Yet there are moments, I would argue, of near blinding clarity and simplicity, and I think we can be certain, I personally feel we can be certain, that the people, those millions of people who suffered between 1845 and 1849, when one out of every eight people died, and in consequence of that, one in every four left, they cannot be expected to appreciate the nuances of ideology or the impact of the Westminster elections of 1847. All that those people could fairly have been expected to expect was that their government would help them. And in that respect, they were abandoned and betrayed in a reprehensibly hideous litany of ways. Chapter 3, A Poem for Mrs. Scriven. In 1855, Mrs. Jane Scriven received a letter from her son Joseph. Over 3,000 miles separated them after Joseph's emigration to Canada from the family home in Banbridge, a town about 20 miles south of Belfast. Although she had a large family still living with her in Ireland, Jane missed her emigrated child intensely, as did so many Irish mothers in the middle of the 1800s. Mrs. Scriven started to sicken with grief over Joseph's absence. No telephones, no calls, no easy way to travel to visit them. Letters, like voyages, took weeks. Often when a child or a loved one emigrated in the 1800s, it meant that their loved ones at home would never see their face again in this life. Hearing how his mother's grief was seriously impacting her health, Joseph composed and enclosed a poem for her with his most recent letter home. Joseph Scriven was a well-educated man. He had taken his bachelor's degree at Trinity College Dublin, one of the best universities in Europe at the time, and he'd found a job eventually in Canada as a private tutor to a wealthy family in South Ontario. Not that the Scrivens themselves were short of money. Joseph's father, John, was a retired army captain. Jane Scriven came from an affluent family of lawyers in Dublin. Joseph's poem to his mother focused on their shared sense of Christian faith. Jane Scriven was an Anglican. Her brother actually was an Anglican vicar serving in England. And in Banbridge, she and the rest of the Scriven family attended Holy Trinity Church, St. Patrick, the local Church of Ireland parish church. By the 1850s, the once strict lines of delineation between the different Protestant denominations had started to blur. Where once it would have been something of a scandal for Church of Ireland congregants to have had much to do with Presbyterians, those particular boundaries of prejudice had largely evaporated thanks to the Act of Union. the largest four denominations in the north of Ireland by the middle of the 19th century, Anglicans, Baptists, Methodists and Presbyterians, coexisted peacefully and even, albeit infrequently at this stage, attended one another's services. Jane's relationship with her son Joseph and their bond being strengthened by their Protestant faith was an example of this, because although Joseph had been born, baptised, raised and confirmed in the Church of Ireland, by the time he wrote this poem to his mother, Joseph had joined the Brethren, a less liturgical, less hierarchical strain of Protestantism, but also one known for encouraging eventually more rigid adherence to biblical literalism than did the Church of Ireland. It was not supposed to have been like this, with Joseph living thousands of miles away in a continent his mother would never see, and from which it would be difficult, dangerous and lengthy for Joseph to return. Until his mid-twenties, Joseph Scriven had trod the path of an upper-middle-class man from a respected County Down family. The farthest he had been from home was to Addiscombe in England, when he had briefly considered following his father into a career in the army. Military college had not been for Joseph, and he'd come back to Ireland to study in his mother's home city of Dublin. After graduation in 1842, he'd fallen in love with a family friend from Banbridge. Incredibly, and this has actually been noted by a couple of other researchers, I have not been able to find out for definite what this lady's name was. Presumably, it would be in the parish records. He was still Church of Ireland at this point, so I would assume she probably was also a member of the Church of Ireland. I didn't want to delay this episode another week in order to find it out, but I am going to find this lady's name out. It's like a little itch under my skin now. It's ridiculous so far that it doesn't seem to be in any of the literature about Joseph Scriven. Very long story short, copy editing my next book this week, so I haven't been able to get down to Banbridge or contact anyone there. But by the end of this season, I am going to try to have found this lady's name out, or at least a couple of credible possibilities. If anyone listening knows of any links to any sort of historical societies in and around Banbridge, do let me know. Anyway, this lady accepted Joseph's proposal of marriage, but in August 1843, there was a freak storm in County Down with very heavy rain. The day before their wedding, Joseph's fiancée was riding her horse in one of the usual spots where locals crossed or forded the River Ban, from which Banbridge Town gained its name. The horse bucked, threw her off, and she drowned in the swollen river waters. What would have been their wedding day instead became the day that the people of Banbridge woke to the news that the future Mrs. Scriven had died. Absolutely devastated by what had happened to his fiancée, Joseph Scriven found comfort in the local Brethren congregations, but not enough, and he decided to restart his life far away from the scenes of this tragedy. It is interesting to note that as support for the union crystallised along religious lines, it seems to have had a knock-on effect on the patterns of Irish emigration, where Irish Catholics at the time overwhelmingly, although of course not universally, but overwhelmingly chose to emigrate to the United States, Irish Protestants increasingly preferred to emigrate to somewhere in the British Empire, with Canada proving the most popular. Once he got to Canada, Joseph supported himself as a labourer before getting work, as mentioned, as a tutor. On his days off or his evenings off, he preached the Bible. He tried different denominations to find a church that worked for him, including going back to Anglicanism. He gave Presbyterianism a whir. He became engaged again, although this fiancée too passed away before their wedding after contracting pneumonia. He was a big gentleman. He's described by a neighbour, as a big man of pleasant countenance. Joseph was sincerely admired in his new Canadian hometown of Port Hope, where people nicknamed him the Good Samaritan. On weekends, when he had days off from being a tutor, full days off, Joseph went back to work as a labourer, but only for families who could not afford to pay him, for he considered this the best way to show Christianity as his faith through action. Joseph's poem to his mother, his grieving mother, was somewhere between a prayer and a poem. And the words were so beautiful that James Scriven shared them. They ended up in a hymnal for the first time in 1865. A small collection of Joseph's poems was published in 1869, but it was only after his death in 1886 that Scriven's work became famous. Tragedy by water had come once again when, on a sweltering Canadian night, Joseph Scriven collapsed and drowned in the local lake. The poem that he had written in Canada for his mother in Banbridge went on to become one of the most famous and beloved modern Christian hymns under the title What a Friend, or What a Friend We Have in Jesus. If you listen to the words and the music, for want of a better word, to which it was set, I think it owes a lot to the necessary simplicity of Protestant worship in many of these communities, as it was with the Presbyterians in the rural communities where Scriven grew up. So it was with many Protestant congregations in Canada. They could not always count on having somebody there who knew how to play the piano, or at many congregations couldn't afford one for their church. So there's something appropriate about the fact that this poem that became a hymn can be performed a cappella or with music. And brethren communities, especially at the time Scriven was writing, relied on congregations being able to sing a cappella, as it were. Joseph Scriven's words, preserved by his mother and set to music by an American admirer, became one of the most beloved Protestant hymns of the 19th and 20th centuries. And it has been sung at countless funerals in Scriven's homeland off the north of Ireland. Born as it was, this hymn that now goes by the title What a Friend We Have in Jesus was born from a life with many tragedies and a great deal of goodness. When I was thinking about this while I was researching and recording, I'm not someone who tries to take the religion out of religious history, and I'm not doing that here. The Christ-centered message of the poem shouldn't be watered down. That's not what Scriven intended when he wrote it. And I don't think, you know, whether you're a person of that religion, a different religion or no religion, that the only way we can empathize with people in the past is if we agree with them. But what I will say, supplemental to the religious, the spiritual message of what a friend we have in Jesus, I was thinking about that really obvious point I made earlier, in that there's no phone, there's no video calls, there's no easy way to get back. And I know that sounds trivial and staggeringly obvious, but it's one of those things that you think and then really think about. And for people who emigrated, it must have been like a kind of death for their families. The likelihood that they would never see them again, not just live with them again, that physically they would never see this person again, was very, very high. In the 1800s, when Scriven was writing. And so along with the spirituality of the song, I think there's something unifying about music. And I have to wonder about the idea of Jesus as the universal figure at the heart of Christianity, and music being the universal the universal unifier at the heart of the human experience. And I think about James Scriven reading this and congregations in Banbridge singing this while congregations in Ontario were singing it. So I think there's a universality about music that I find very moving. But this is the first verse of What a Friend We Have in Jesus, lyrics by Joseph Scriven. Chapter 4, the death of Mary Ann McCracken. An old lady with failing eyesight gave a hearty cheer when, in the middle of 1865, she was read the headline news that the Confederate States of America had ceased to exist. As had many other British citizens, the people of Belfast had followed the news of America's Civil War with interest. In 1865, the other American Republic fell to the armies of the one it had tried to leave. For all 4 years of its existence, the Confederacy had been at war with the Northern United States, with the United States emerging triumphant to reincorporate the surrendered Confederate States. It was correctly expected that something else would follow the Confederacy into the dustbin of history, the institution of slavery. The issue that had, far more than anything else, proved the dividing issue between the two American republics. With the Confederacy's disintegration, only the Brazilian Empire continued to operate a racially based slave system against people of African descent. For 94-year-old Mary Ann McCracken, who had lived in Belfast all her life, the implosion of the Confederacy was both welcome and long overdue. 6 years earlier, she had urged the people of Belfast to stop referring to America in sympathetic or admiring terms. America, Mary Ann argued, should not be considered the land of the great or the brave anymore. It may more properly be styled the land of the tyrant and the slave. A devout Presbyterian, Mary Ann had been baffled and appalled by slavery's longevity in the United States, as she made clear in this letter read by actress Marianne McGuire.
The world seems in a sad state of wickedness just now. I do not know how to account for it. Considering all the efforts that are and have been made for many years past to encourage the moral, religious, and intellectual improvement of the civilized world, and particularly in the United States of America, where the diabolical system of slavery is increasing and progressing. And the worst part is that so many people in America who profess to be the most pious Christians uphold and apologise for the slavery system. Surely that's quite inconsistent with all the teachings of him whose followers they profess to be. But perhaps a crisis is near about slavery. And it may be sooner than we expect that the eyes of the oppressors will be opened.
Mary Ann McCracken had been an activist almost since the cradle. She saw a world in need of improvement, and she didn't see why she shouldn't help with the improving. The fifth of six children, she was born in 1770 into a prosperous Belfast family. Her father was a city merchant. Her mother's family owned the Belfast Newsletter. Hers was a family who believed in radical politics, Christian values, and in educating their daughters as well as they did their sons. Mary Ann was schooled alongside her brother Henry, to whom she was particularly close. When she was 6 years old, her family hosted parties in Belfast to celebrate the success of the American revolutionaries in their quest to create a republic independent from the British Empire. Aged 19, Mary Ann had joined in the celebrations and Belfast parties that greeted news of the fall of the Bastille prison to rioters in Paris, hoping that France's new revolution would be an inspirational step towards the end of tyranny everywhere. Mary Ann first became truly aware of the issue of slavery when she was 11 years old. And her mother was mortified, enraged even, when her family-owned newspaper, the Belfast Newsletter, posted an ad for a runaway slave who had escaped the house where he was being kept when his masters brought him with them on a visit to Belfast. In conjunction with the ad, a hunt was organised throughout Belfast for the escaped young man, described in the newspaper as an Indian black, which meant, in the nomenclature of slavery, somebody with Native American and African ancestry. Marianne's father was so furious by attempts to recapture the escaped man that he helped organise a campaign throughout Belfast to help the runaway, who he described in an article as the equal of anybody in Belfast. "We will not only harbour him," Captain McCracken promised, "but we will enable him, by donations, to carry on a legal prosecution against his intended enslaver." So the McCrackens not only helped set up a fund, I found out, to target the enslaver and help the runaway, they also helped set up a safe house on High Street for the runaway to hide and seek shelter. Marianne, with a strong sweet tooth, joined a boycott of sugar in Belfast in protest of sugar's inextricable links with the slave trade. When she was a little older, aged 16 in 1786, Marianne was old enough to join in with her family's abolitionist politics by attending large protests against new commercial proposals to set up a slave trading ship company based in Belfast. When a petition went about to see how much support there would be for slave trading, or at least slave trading companies, to be based and permitted in Belfast, a McCracken family friend didn't leave much room for doubt on his views when he proclaimed, "May God wither the hand and consign the name to eternal infamy any man who will sign that document." The proposal was defeated, and the slave trading company was not permitted to establish an office in Belfast. Marianne was 21 when the Nigerian aristocrat Oladoye Kwiano visited Belfast to provide his testimony before crowds as a victim and survivor of American slavery. I have a full episode on Equiano's extraordinary life in Season 2, Episode 5 of this podcast for anyone who is interested in finding out more about his, just utterly remarkable life. Like many Northern Presbyterians at the time, the McCracken family sympathised with the Republican movement emerging in Ireland in the 1790s. If America and France had done it, why couldn't Ireland? In what was to become a long-running tension within Irish republicanism, Marianne encouraged its leaders to promise that the civil rights they were working for would be extended to Irish women just as much as it would be to Irish men. The failure of this to be done, particularly after 1921 to 1922, was to become a source of contention in Irish nationalist historiography. But it's clear that Marianne McCracken was among the first, maybe quite possibly the first, to urge it after devouring the works of English feminist philosophers like Mary Wollstonecraft. Two of Marianne McCracken's brothers, William and her favourite Henry, joined the Society of the United Irishmen, and Henry helped lead a major part of the uprising in the North, which, like all parts of the 1798 rebellion, was defeated by the Crown and by Loyalist forces. In the aftermath of the rebellion's defeat, Belfast was placed under military curfew, and Henry McCracken vanished into hiding with a bounty on his head. Knowing that he and his friends were likely hiding yet hungry and scared, Marianne stole out into the curfewed streets and took herself at great risk up to the hills surrounding Belfast until she found her brother on Cave Hill. Marianne brought him clothes and helped keep him hidden until they could get him to a boat that would take Henry to safety in America. On her 28th birthday, Marianne received the news that their plan to get Henry out of the country had failed. Henry had been arrested at the harbour and taken to jail in the northern port of Carrickfergus. Marianne refused to leave her brother's side at his trial, and she accompanied him, holding his hand, through the streets of Belfast to the scaffold where he was publicly hanged for sedition and treason on Belfast High Street on the 17th of July 1798. His last words to her had been, "I did my duty." Marianne and her sister Margaret took in Henry's illegitimate child, Maria. The two sisters set up a home together and then a business, a clothing business, that also made, or specialised in, I should say, muslin cloths, and it provided excellent wages, care, and fair working hours for her workers. Bitterly opposed to the Act of Union, Mary Anne used some of their business's profits to pay for the legal defence teams of Irish Republicans who stood trial in the town of Downpatrick in 1803. Away from the issue of Irish independence, Mary Anne joined a Belfast Lady Society that focused on alleviating poverty for women and girls in the town. She campaigned against the use of child labour in chimney sweeping in Belfast. She was a founding member of a committee that aimed to provide clothing to the Belfast destitute. She raised awareness against the dangers of alcohol. She campaigned to improve living conditions in Irish prisons, and she taught in a local Protestant Sunday school for years. In her heart, I truly believe Mary Anne remained a Republican, but when King William IV died in 1837 and was succeeded to the throne by his niece, Princess Victoria of Kent, Mary Anne announced that she'd made her peace with the Union and that it had finally delivered on its promise to end many of the grievances that had inspired her brothers to rebel in 1798. Like many other sympathisers with Irish independence, Mary Anne, of course, had reason to rethink her views in the next decade when the Great Hunger struck. But part of the reason I suspect why she could greet the death of King William IV in 1837 with such magnanimity was because, along with his late brother's enacting of Catholic emancipation, it had been during William IV's reign that Parliament had outlawed slavery in the British Empire, which for Mary Anne was something she'd prayed for and campaigned for since she was a child. The Empire's abolition of slavery under William IV made the United States' continued acceptance of slavery in an admittedly diminishing number of states, but it was still permissible, even more repugnant to Mary Anne. When it was still in existence and apparently even hoping to expand westward from certain American states a full generation later, Mary Anne was horrified and baffled. In 1845 and again in 1846, she helped host two visits to Belfast by American author, campaigner and survivor of slavery, Frederick Douglass, at which Douglass famously proclaimed, "Instead of the bright blue sky of America, I am covered with the soft grey fog of the Emerald Isle. I breathe, and lo, the chattel becomes a man." Old age, marching inexorably onwards, brought its inevitable catalogue of loss to Mary Anne. Her sister Margaret died in 1829, and Mary Anne later had to give up their fine home on Donegal Street when the rent was hiked up by an unsympathetic landlord. A fundraising effort for her was organised by a sympathiser called Reverend Arthur Chichester Macartney, an ascendancy-born Church of Ireland vicar, a sign of how much attitudes had softened and evolved in some quarters since 1798. She kept busy in her new home in a less expensive part of the city. She wrote letters to and from a friend who was researching an impressive, very impressive, three-volume history of ancient Irish music. She continued to employ a servant who was a Catholic and also illiterate. Mary Anne taught her to read and write, and she firmly rejected Friend's suggestion that she give her a Protestant edition of the Bible. Instead, when the servant come pupil was ready to, Mary Anne went out of her way to find her the Douay-Rheims edition, the Catholic English language translation of the scriptures at the time. She continued to visit some of the last survivors of the 1798 rebellion, like Israel Milliken, who as a young man was imprisoned with her brothers and as an old man was imprisoned by his rheumatism. She answered, as much as she could, researchers' questions about the men she had known, helped, debated with and mourned in 1798 and 1803, as those rebellions stood on the precipice of passing from memory into history. She was delighted to receive an invitation to visit the new Convent of Mercy, Belfast's first nunnery built in the north of the city. And she kept up with family news, like the enrolment of Maria's teenage stepson William at the Royal Belfast Academical Institute, the all-boys school called Inst, still is, in Belfast. Her health lasted until a few weeks after she received the news that the Confederacy had fallen. Then she contracted bronchitis that left her bedridden for some time, and she never fully recovered, mentally nor physically. On the 8th of July, 1866, she turned 96, and I suppose, as with many cases in extreme old age, even purely physical illnesses like bronchitis, they can often have a mental corollary to their impact. The past closed in around Marianne's mind, slowly dimming out the present. The future was no longer her concern. 2 weeks later, she passed away at home. According to one of the many friends and loved ones who looked after her in that final year, in the time between the bronchitis of 1865 and the death in 1866, she faded peacefully and gently away, apparently contented and happy without weariness or pain, until, after she was some hours unconscious, she breathed her last on the 27th of July, 1866. As a young woman, Marianne McCracken had been part of a vibrant community of Ulster Presbyterian Republicans and Radicals. By the time she died, she was an historical and political relic. A Presbyterian Republican was almost by then a contradiction in terms. Largely forgotten in the years after her quiet funeral, in 2021, Belfast City Council voted to honour Marianne McCracken with a statue which, once the final design is selected, will be erected in the grounds of City Hall. When asked about her attitude to a happy life, Marianne once said,
"This world offers no enjoyment equal to that of promoting the happiness of others."
Part 2 of Tales from Victorian Belfast, running from a murder in 1881 to a party in 1903, will be uploaded tomorrow. I've been Gareth Russell. Thank you and take care.